lawyer, whatever that means. As part of my responsibilities as a professor, I'm expected to write brilliant papers that that change the world. So in the process of thinking about some things that had bothered me when I was in practice but didn't have time, I decided to take a look at criminal copyright infringement. And hence we're here today to talk a little about some of what I found. And in the process of looking at criminal copyright infringement, it's impossible not to focus squarely on where's trading, which is essential not only to understanding the history of the law, but it's also essential to understanding a major chunk of activity out there that creates interesting issues from a legal standpoint. I wrote up as part of the conference materials a relatively lengthy descriptive article about this topic, which for whatever reason I don't believe is in the big red book. It should be on your CD-ROM. Has anyone actually been able to open it on the CD-ROM? Has anyone actually seen it? I tried to open it, and I'm using an antiquated computer, so I'm not sure it actually worked. There's a lengthy companion piece to this that includes a summary table of all of the various prosecutions that have occurred of Ware's traders, and it also includes a little story about each prosecution. And one of the things I was actually hoping to get from this conversation was, I bet some of you know some of the people who I wrote about and probably can tell me the real story and not the story that I discovered in my research. And I would welcome that dialogue. So if you have a chance to take a look at the companion piece, and if you have some thoughts and perspectives about it, I invite you to come and let me know. I would very much value your insights. I tried to think about what might be interesting to this particular audience. And I came up with three reasons why you guys might be here. I assume some of you are interested in the topic generally, whether because you're interested in criminal copyright infringement or just in the Ware's trading phenomenon. I suspect a few of you in this room are interested in going after Ware's traders. I'm not going to ask you to self-identify, but I suspect some of you have that on your list. And then I'm guessing the rest of you are probably here because you consider yourself a Ware's trader and you're interested in how the law affects your activity. With respect to the going after Ware's traders, I probably am going to have some tips and recommendations for you that I'm not sure are immediately obvious. As for the personal interest in Ware's trading because you're wondering what you can do, the news isn't all that good, actually. I don't have a whole lot of cheery insights that are going to alleviate some of your concerns. But I can tell you why the news is not cheery, and maybe that's about the best a law professor can ever expect out of life. But what we're going to cover today are four main points. We're going to talk about my definition of Ware's trading, and we'll just spend a few moments on that. I trust most of you already have a common definition, the same as my own. We'll talk about the applicable criminal laws, both copyright and a few others that might be of interest. I'll give you some squibs about some of the prosecutions that have taken place. As I said, the companion piece tells the story of each of these in a little more detail and gives you the summary chart of who's actually been busted and for what. And then finally, I'll give you a few policy concerns. And I have, I think, a few things to say there that you might find interesting. But let me give you the conclusion at the beginning. The conclusion is pretty straightforward. Ware's trading has been criminalized, and the likely consequence of what Congress has done seems unavoidable, that more Ware's traders are going to be going to jail. And that may not sound all that radical, but let me tell you why that's the case, and maybe that'll be a little bit more interesting. Let's start with the definition of Ware's trading. I trust that most everyone in this room makes a very big distinction between Ware's trading and commercial piracy. Congress does not, or at least Congress doesn't have any precision in its thinking about the differences between the two. But Ware's trading is obviously the exchange of copyrighted works, shorthand of wares, for not-for-profit, usually as part of some ego initiative. And I'll talk about the ego thing in just a moment. Commercial piracy is taking someone's copyrighted work and making money from it. And I think it's fair to say that Ware's traders not only distinguish themselves from commercial piracy, but generally have a very strong ethic that strongly opposes commercial piracy. I think Ware's Traders may very well be the most quintessential bastion of software wants to be free, or information wants to be free. We've all heard this mantra throughout the discussions about internet law and policy. And yet, here I think we have perhaps the purest group that encapsulates that belief. But I think the more interesting thing about Ware's Trading is that it is easy to lump together Ware's Traders into a single monolithic group, and I don't think that's fair. I think there are different sub-communities in the Ware's Trading scene that should be distinguished, because I think they are different motivations, and I also think that they are different from a legal standpoint at some level or another, and we'll talk about that in a moment. And I break the Ware's Trading scene down into four different groups. We have the Ware's Distribution Groups. These are the large organizations that are set up for the rapid dissemination of wares. They make their mark as a group by being the fastest to release the most difficult hacks. I distinguish these people from the wares collectors, and this is not a bright line distinction, but I think there's a different subcommunity in the wares scene of one-off individuals, or people who generally do their own thing. They're into wares trading, but they're not part of a group. Maybe they want to become part of the group, and they're in their training ground. Maybe they just want to trade wares in their own little environment because they don't want it to be a big process. They don't want to sign up to group requirements. They just want to do their own thing. But I think that there are two different communities, and I think distinguishing them helps understand a little bit about some of the prosecutions and some of the weird choices that prosecutors have made. I would put a third group as the wares downloaders. These are people who are not really traders, they're just mooching for free. And they obviously are part of the scene, and they are an integral part of the scene, but they are definitely not into the trading piece of it. They're just looking for something either for free or something that's new and cool faster than their friends have it. I put a fourth category of wares traders down that doesn't get as much discussion, but I'm not sure why. I think it's an important part of the scene. And these are the abandonware enthusiasts. By abandonware, I'm talking about copyrighted works, almost invariably games, where the copyright owner has decided not to continue commercializing it. We all have our favorite games from days of yore. I'm not going to date myself by telling you my favorite games, but you all know which ones were favorite when you were 15 or when you were younger than that. And many of those are no longer available commercially, right? They've just been removed from the market. And then abandonware enthusiasts like to try and preserve those games as part of our cultural literacy. From a legal standpoint, I cannot make a distinction between abandonware traders and other wares enthusiasts. Abandonware enthusiasts and other wares traders. And so as a result, I think they belong on the list. But their motivations are slightly different, and we'll talk a little about if that matters from a legal standpoint. Let me lay out the basics of criminal copyright law. There are two different ways that someone can violate the law. One can violate it by willfully infringing copyrighted works for commercial gain or private financial, commercial advantage or private financial gain. The other way that someone can commit criminal copyright infringement is by willfully infringing copyrighted works by reproducing or distributing them where the total quantum of infringement is $1,000 of retail value in a 180-day period. The punishments for violating this law can be, I think, modestly severe. I say modestly only because the government has, in its infinite wisdom, made other types of activities even subject to more harsh penalties. But someone who violates this law can go to prison for up to 5 years and receive a $250,000 fine. What I'd like to do is lay out each of the different elements that the prosecutor has to establish to prove a wares trading case, distilling the previous elements I just discussed up here into some numerical elements. So let's start with the first. In order for the prosecutor to win and prove that someone criminally committed copyright infringement, first they have to establish that a valid copyrighted work exists. Validity is actually shown one of two ways. It can be shown through registration with the Copyright Office, which many copyright owners do, not all do, or it can be shown just by establishing the elements of a valid copyright. I believe that almost all wares traders only trade in valid copyrighted works. It's almost not interesting, I would think, to trade in public domain works or in shareware or in something that everyone else could get. It's kind of the point. So my belief is that this element will almost always be met in any wares trading case. Now, in order to establish criminal cover infringement, the next element is establishing that an infringement occurred. And infringement is actually much easier to prove than you guys might expect. My rule of thumb is, if you can see a copy, you can find infringement. Basically, every time a copy is made, that is grounds for a potential infringement. So you can imagine all the different ways in which all of us, and specifically wares traders, make copies. When someone uploads a copy of a copyrighted work from their hard drive to a central server, there's a copy. When someone sends an email or distributes via Usenet a copyrighted work, there's a copy. When someone downloads a wares from a central server, from Usenet, or from their email into their hard drive, there's a copy. So as you can see, pretty much you should have no problem establishing what I call a prima facie case of infringement. Anytime you see a copy, and when you're dealing with something like wares trading, you're going to find lots of copies. So as a result, the prima facie case of infringement is relatively easy to establish. Now, having said that, the meat of establishing a winning prosecution for criminal cover infringement is overcoming the evidentiary challenges. What do I mean by this? So we all know that the computers that are being used by wares traders are making lots of copies. However, in order for the prosecutor to win, the prosecutor has to connect that particular defendant with those particular copies. And that obviously is not as easy as it might sound. How would one go about doing that? One could do it by, for example, showing that someone's username and password can be associated with particular copies being made. Correct? Right? That would be, I think most of us would feel, a relatively rigorous way of associating a particular individual with a particular set of actions. However, if a defendant says, someone stole my password and username, what's the prosecutor going to do then? Another way that the evidence could be shown connecting infringement with a particular defendant is through something like an IP address analysis. You could show, for example, that a particular IP address was used to commit an infringing copy, and then you try and figure out who was associated with that particular IP address at that particular time. I guess most of you in this room would say, I could figure out a way to do that, but I'm guessing a number of you would say, boy, that would just be a pain. It would take some time to do, and it wouldn't be all that much fun work. And if you're the government, you may not very well have access to the very best information, right? You won't necessarily have a copy of those server logs available for you to do that careful mapping of IP address to infringing activity. The way that the government has been not trying to overcome that is by setting up these surreptitious sites that they infiltrate where they can actually record the activity by owning the server logs directly. Obviously, then they have access to the server logs, but still taking that information and connecting it to a particular individual defendant is going to be some work. It's not a guaranteed way to go. The other way that the government's overcoming the evidentiary challenge is by getting a member of a wares trading group to fess up, right? And you all know this about, say, for example, encrypted communications. An encrypted communication is great unless one of the two ends of the encrypted communication spills the beans, at which point that information becomes freely available. And so if the government can get any one of a group of wares traders to say, you got me, why don't I go and help you in exchange for more leniency, all of a sudden all that information comes out and the government gets a lot better information that they can use to go after the rest of the group. What the government does not want to do and has shown great reluctance to do is prosecute cases based strictly on circumstantial evidence. They want some kind of reliable evidence that they can take to a jury or to a judge that will overcome some inherent biases that juries might otherwise feel about prosecuting Ware's traitors. It's not to say that Ware's traitors will be loved by juries, but it is to say that when a prosecution is brought for non-commercial infringement, the juries are naturally going to be less likely to pull the trigger on a particular defendant. And if that evidence is marshaled up that's only circumstantial, I can only inferentially show that this particular person engaged in that particular activity, it makes it that much more unlikely that the government is going to win its case, and as a result, much less likely for the government to want to bring it. The evidentiary challenge is a significant issue. It is perhaps the single biggest lever that prevents the government from going after more Ware's traitors. There are a couple of major defenses that a Ware's traitor can bring to fend off a particular prosecution. One of the primary defenses to criminal copyright infringement generally is the first sale doctrine. Many of you have probably heard of this doctrine. Maybe not all of you have understood what it meant. When I buy a book from a bookstore, I acquire the ownership of that particular copy of the book. I don't own the copyrighted material, but I own the hard copy of that book. And the first sale doctrine says I can take that book and I can lend it to my friends, I can resell it to somebody else, I can destroy it if I want to do. That particular copy is fair game for me to do whatever I want in terms of distributing it on to other people. The first sale doctrine, unfortunately, has no bearing in electronic environments because it is only a defense to distribution. It is not a defense to, for example, copying. So as a result, when a Ware's trader moves a file from their desktop to somewhere else, they not only distribute it from their desktop to somewhere else, but they also copy it from their desktop to somewhere else. As a result, the first sale doctrine is irrelevant because it won't provide a defense to the copying. And as a result, it doesn't actually mitigate any of the potential infringement. Did you have a question? The law professor community wants that to be the law, and many of them will take the position it should be the law, but that's not the law. Yeah. I'm sorry, I should have reiterated. The question previously was, if I delete the copy when I distribute it, does that change the analysis under first sale doctrine? Answer, no. The question now is, if that copy is truly unique, does that become a defense? I think the answer is still the same. The first sale doctrine only applies, in my opinion, to hard copy versions of a copyrighted work. And the fact that it's digital, by definition, in my opinion, takes it out of the first sale doctrine. I think that the argument that could be made to try and squeeze in the notion that if there was truly a unique copy that was not capable of being distributed, therefore it should be protected by the first sale doctrine. But then you're actually saying it wasn't distributed in a sense, right? You're attacking it. If you make a copy, that copy is the infringing activity. And the distribution is kind of beside the point from my perspective. I see a bunch of questions. You know, would you guys mind if let me keep powering through because I know you guys have a ton of questions. And I'm going to leave plenty of time to tackle them all. Is that okay, or is there something specific to this point on first sale that we should continue exploring? Okay, yeah, let me take that question. So the question was, does archival copying constitute copyright infringement, right? Well, let me distinguish the two. Archival copying is actually subject to a statutory safe harbor that was codified a few years ago. So you actually have a permission to make that copy. But remember, my touchstone principle, if you see a copy, you see an infringement unless you can find a defense. And those defenses are not as easy to find as you would like them to be or as we need them to be in a computer environment. Let me talk about the other major defense to criminal copyright infringement, and this is fair use. You all have heard the language fair use, you know that this is intended to be a major incursion into this every copy is infringement. It's designed to be the safe harbor that allows certain copies to be permissible despite the literal text of the statute. And the fair use defense has four elements: the nature of the use, the nature of the work, the amount taken, and the effect on the market. And I'd like to just say a few words about all four of those elements, if you wouldn't mind. Let's start with the nature of the use. Congress contemplated that uses that were educational in nature would be more like fair use. They would be more encouraged and protected from an infringement attack. Commercial copying, by contrast, is less like fair use. It's more like you're just taking someone's copyright work and making money for yourself. Clearly, wares trading doesn't really fit in either bucket. It's neither commercial, by definition. It's also not really educational. And I know some of you would make some arguments, but I'm sorry, they're not likely to really persuade me, and I'm doubtful they're going to persuade anyone else in a court of law. So where does that leave us on this first factor? Where does this come out? And there are a couple other ways that courts analyze this first factor. For example, some courts talk about a copy that is transformative in nature. Take, for example, a parody. You make a copy of the underlying work that's being parodied in order to create a parody of it, but it also adds some commentary to it, and it changes it somehow. And the Supreme Court has said a transformative work is more like fair use, and therefore more eligible for the defense. I don't think you're going to find a whole lot of benefit under the transformative standard for a wares. Certainly, some wares are not the same as the underlying work, but generally the goal is to make them as close as possible, right? At minimum, to replicate most or all the good functionality of the underlying work that's being copied. And so I don't think that's what the Supreme Court meant by transformative. I think it's pretty much exactly what they would consider not really transformative. It's basically a verbatim copy of it. And for those of you who have tracked the legal developments with respect to Napster, the Napster court dealt with this issue somewhat and talked about MP3 files that were being copied by file sharing users and whether their activity was protected under this first prong. And the court articulated a slightly different standard than we've seen in the past. It said when Congress used the word commercial to define a not protected fair use, what they really meant was repeated an exploitative copying. And as a result, the Napster court found that individual personal users of the Napster software were engaged in, quote, commercial-like copying because they made repeated and exploitative copying. And I would assert to you that if individual personal downloading of MP3 files is considered repeated and exploitative copying, I'm guessing wares trading is as well. You can see where I'm headed with this. Chances are this first factor does not weigh in the wares trader's favor. The nature of the work distinguishes between fiction work and factual work. Fictional work is the kind of work that has been protected since days of yore with the powdered wig dudes. And factual database works are really very thinly protected by copyright law generally. And so the fair use analysis contemplates that there's two ends of a spectrum: this core copyrighted work, these things that have been protected forever, and these things that are subject to very thin copyright protection. And generally, the point of wares is to take something that's a lot closer to the end of the spectrum that's like fictional work. Now, you'd say software is kind of a weird hybrid. It's functional is in nature, usually. Where does that fit? And I think software generally will fit a little closer to the fictional end of the spectrum than to the factual end of the spectrum. You could imagine software that doesn't, and so there might be some exceptions to that. But by and large, I think that this factor is likely to weigh against fair use because chances are software or the other works being traded by wares traders will be closer to the core copyrighted work that was contemplated at the beginning of copyright protection. The third factor looks at the amount taken. Was the entire copyrighted work taken or some subset? And this one almost invariably will weigh against wares traders. They take pretty much the whole thing. And then the final factor under fair use is the effect on the market. And I would guess that most of this in the audience would have a very visceral reaction to this statement. Wares trading has no real effect on the market. We all know that very few wares traders would ever buy anything that they trade. There is some exceptions to that, and there is, I think, a proto-ethic among wares traders that says, if you really, really love this thing, you should buy it and reward the copyright owner for building something that you really, really love. And so I think, if anything, there's an understanding among wares traders that if there would have been a detrimental effect on the market, you should go and buy it and remove that detrimental effect. So from that perspective, I think wares traders would often take the very aggressive position that there is no effect on the market that's detrimental to copyright owners. And I think that the analytics supporting that statement should back it generally up. I believe that that's generally the right result. Now, having said that, we have the problem with wares downloaders who, if they are part of the scene, they are mooching. And those moochers might very well end up having been truly lost sales. It's not a perfect one-to-one correlation. We all know that. But there's certainly some potential for lost sales by the virtue of wares being available for downloading by downloaders. And I think that makes it very likely that many courts will weigh this factor against wares traders. I think the even more damning evidence is the very limited empirical evidence that suggests that many of the commercial pirates get their source of goods from the wares scene. I can't give you great evidence of that. I think we have some evidence of that. And that some evidence, I think, is very likely to be the kind of thing that a judge or a jury will look at and say, wow, if these people were helping those pirates in Asia, they should stop. And as a result, my belief is that it's very likely that this factor will weigh against wares traders, despite the more visceral reaction that we have, that we know that wares trading really is not intended and has very light and limited effects on the market for the copyrighted work. Fair use is an equitable defense. It is a multi-factor test that judges apply and juries apply to try and reach what I'll call, quote, the right result. If there is evidence of infringement, but it's not right that particular type of infringement should be squelched, then fair use offers up a way for the judge and the jury to extract that particular activity from the otherwise restrictive provisions of infringement. My gut tells me that most judges and most juries will not consider wares trading to be that type of activity that warrants that special protection of an equitable defense. When you cut through all of the factors and all of the arguments that we could make, the likely conclusion is, when you step back and say, is this the kind of thing that we want to encourage, I'm guessing most judges and most juries will not subscribe to that. And therefore, even if we could make a technical argument to make each of these factors weigh in favor of fair use, I still think that would miss the equitable nature of the defense and the likely consequences when it's applied in the field. I'm still talking about the elements of a prosecution, and the next major element we need to discuss is willfulness. What does it mean for someone to willfully infringe? And there is a debate about what this word means. If I could, I would banish the word willfulness from use in legal statutes, because it is an inherently ambiguous word. And one of Congress's typical things is, when there's an ambiguous word and there's a split in the parties or a split between House and Senate about defining it, they say, you know what, we'll just let the courts figure it out. And they punt, which is what they did when they last touched the statute. They punted on this definition. They said, you know what, it's too hard to define, we'll let somebody else do it. There is a minority view about the definition of willfulness. It says, if you had the intent to make the copy, you have engaged in willful behavior. That minority of view, of course, would guarantee that every wares trader has engaged in willful behavior, right? There is no doubt about that. But I think that minority view is dead. And that's my prediction. We don't have any evidence yet to support that. But I believe that the majority view is going to become the prevailing view. The majority view says that it is a willful infringement only when the defendant engaged in a voluntary, intentional violation of a known legal duty. Now, those are kind of ambiguous words from your perspective, I'm guessing. Let me tell you what that means. It creates three new defenses that would not exist under the minority view. One of the defenses would be that there was a good faith but incorrect belief that the defendant was not engaged in infringing activity. So if the defendant had a correct belief that they were not infringing, the case is over, we fail the last element of the prosecution. But if the defendant believed they were not infringing, but they were, that still might be a defense under the majority view, because their belief, if it was good faith, would negate the activity as being done in a voluntary intentional violation of a known legal duty. In other words, they didn't know what the legal duty was because they thought they were engaged in legal activity. This would come up with things like if the defendant was uncertain if the work was eligible for copyright protection, or if the work was if the use was protected by the first sale doctrine. That's where this type of factor would come up. I don't think that's going to end up meaning much to Ware's Traders. I don't think they're going to get a whole lot of traction on the non-infringement belief. Notice that another of the defenses that arises under the majority view is a good faith but incorrect belief of fair use. So remember, I've taken the position now that Ware's Trading is generally not fair use. But I could make arguments otherwise, as all of you could. And that might support a good faith belief that that the activity was fair use, even if it turns out that the judge or the jury decides that it was not. And this is, I think, probably the single biggest defense that Ware's Traders can use if they ever get prosecuted. Remember, the first attack is the actual evidence that they were the ones committing the infringement activity. But this is, once the prosecutors pull the trigger, they're pretty convinced that they're going to win on that piece. But they may not be able to defend against this psychological belief that Ware's Traders had that their use was fair. Now, having said that, the case law does not support the belief that Ware's Trading is fair use. So, for example, the Napster Court and the Amster Court have both said that file sharing is not fair use, end of the story, not really even debatable. And so one could imagine the prosecutors introducing cases like that saying, it's obvious that the case law says that this type of activity is not fair use, therefore there was no way for any defendant to have a good faith belief otherwise. And that's just an untested argument, and we'll have to see how that plays out. I think that's definitely the best opportunity for Ware's Traders is to attack the good faith but incorrect belief of fair use. The final defense that was created by the majority view is ignorance of the law. You can't violate a known legal duty if you don't know what the legal duty is. And I think that this defense is actually going to be rather unavailing for Ware's Traders. And the reason why is I think most Ware's Traders have a pretty good sense that they're violating someone's rights. They may not understand the parameters of criminal copyright infringement, as well as you guys will after this talk, but they understand enough to know that they're taking something that they shouldn't have. And I believe that that's a pretty well understood psychology among Ware's Traders. If that's the case, I don't think that they're going to be able to legitimately claim ignorance of the law. They will definitely be ignorant about criminal copyright infringement, but I think that the knowledge that they are violating someone's rights will support the definition of what's considered willfulness. So in all told, I think the willfulness factor is not the Ware's Traders' friend. The only hope is to make this good faith but incorrect belief of fair use, and even that might fail based on some of the case law today suggesting otherwise. The final element of a prosecution is one of the following two. I didn't know how to reflect that these are ors. The prosecutors have to show either commercial advantage or private financial gain, or that the amount of activity cleared a retail value threshold. Let's talk about each. Clearly, Ware's Traders, by definition, do not engage in commercial advantage infringement, right? By definition. However, Congress, in 1997, amended the definition of financial gain. It's one of these classic lawyer tricks. It's one of the reasons why you guys all hate lawyers, because Congress redefined financial gain to incur even when there was no financial gain. Okay, you following so far? The definition of financial gain includes the receipt or expectation of receipt of anything of value, including the receipt of other copyrighted works. you guys can imagine exactly why Congress put these words in. They wanted to cover where's trading with these words, right? And one can make an argument they hit the nail on the head. That if someone is truly in the business, not for money, but for other benefits, of trading works, give me software in exchange for something I've got, they will meet this definition, no questions asked. I think that the wares trading scene has developed a new ethic since 1997. I believe that many wares traders now take the position they don't care if they get anything in return. It's not about getting something back, it's about the reputation that they develop. And therefore, there's no expectation of receipt of anything of value. They don't want that. All they want is the acknowledgement that they did something that someone else had not, that other people had not done. Now, what the prosecutors are going to argue is they're going to say the only way for a wares trader to maintain that reputation is by continuing to develop new, to disseminate new wares. And the only way they're going to get new wares is by having disseminated lots of stuff, and then people are going to help them get it, right? That's a way of developing a supply of wares is to be known as one of the groups that's known for doing the early cracks. And as a result, I think the prosecutors are going to argue there is an implicit expectation of receipt based on having a good reputation, creating a new source of supply that maintains the reputation. I don't know if that argument's going to work. I think that the argument could be strictly on the face of the statute. It doesn't have any implied expectation. There has to be some real bona fide expectation of receipt. And if someone is just doing it for altruism or for ego, but with no expectations of anything coming back to them that's material, that should drop them out of the standard of commercial advantage or private financial gain. And those arguments are untested, but I think that those arguments are coming. The reason why the prosecutors want to establish this private financial gain is that it actually increases the remedies. The maximum jail sentence for meeting this element is 5 years. For clearing the retail value threshold is 3 years. And prosecutors are measured by things like how long do they put someone in jail for. So for them, it's a juicier target to try and get people under the private financial gain. I expect that that's where we're going to see most of the action in the future. The retail value prong is the alternative. If they can't establish private financial gain, they merely have to show that there was $2,500 of retail value infringed to establish a felony, but if they just want to bust somebody for a misdemeanor, all they have to show is $1,000 of retail infringement, a retail value of infringement, and that person is clear the threshold. I know what you guys are thinking. It is the obvious question. How does one compute retail value? There are 1,000 different prices for a single object, right? In fact, copyright owners have incentives to engage in various forms of price discrimination. There should, by definition, be multiple levels of pricing. And in fact, one could argue the appropriate price to look at is the price that the infringer sold or disseminated the work for, which in the wares scene would be zero. And so one could argue that the appropriate way of computing it, the amount of infringement committed by wares traders by looking at how much they sold their items for, which is zero, they will never clear this threshold, right? And this is another one of Congress's punts. They could have defined retail value. They didn't. We don't know how retail value is supposed to be computed for the prima facie case. However, for the sentencing guidelines, after someone's been found guilty, there's a chart that establishes the points of bad action on a numerical basis and then the associated penalties that judges are allowed to give them. And in the process of computing the association between points and penalties, there is a definition of retail value in these sentencing guidelines. And the definition of retail value in the sentencing guidelines says that retail value shall be the price of the infringing copies. In other words, in the wares scene, zero, unless a bunch of things. And those bunch of things include things like it was a verbatim copy, or it is hard to establish the appropriate value for the particular work at issue. What that means in practice is that for sentencing guideline purposes, retail value is always going to be computed at the manufacturer's list price, not at the price of the infringing goods. Even though the definition sets it up, that's your baseline. The baseline is the price of the wares. But the default gets shifted, I think, in every case involving a wares trading prosecution. And all of you must then put two and two together and say, if the benchmark is $1,000, the manufacturer's list price, it doesn't take very many infringing items to clear that threshold. Would you all agree with that? Right? It could be one pretty easily. Now, one of the points I want everyone to take away from this talk is that I have outlined what I would consider to be a rather gloomy perspective on the consequences of criminal copyright infringement on wares trading. I said at the beginning of the talk that the news is not good, and I think after having talked you through all of the elements that the prosecutor has established, it should be relatively clear why, right? Basically, prosecutors will have very little difficulty establishing a case of infringement against most wares traders. But I think the worst news for wares trading is that criminal copyright infringement is not the only law that likely applies to their activity. And there's a professor at Harvard Law School who described a process called charge stacking. I want to talk a little about charge stacking because I like that phrase. You think about a deck being stacked against you like it is here in Vegas, right? What prosecutors can do is stack the deck against defendants by bringing multiple charges all covering the same behavior. And Congress, as a business model or as a policy-making process, routinely gives the prosecutors multiple charges covering the same exact behavior. That allows the prosecutor to say, I'm not sure if I can win on all four of these. I'm going to put all four of them on the table against the defendant. And that's going to scare the defendant. And when the defendant realizes that, they're going to cave in faster because one of these might stick. And if any one of these stick, they're going to jail. And so they're going to be more likely to cooperate when I do what's called charge stacking. And there are a bunch of tools available for the prosecutors to use to charge stack against wares trading defendants. Let me give you some examples. One of the things I also want you to realize, some of you may be familiar with the LaMacchia case back from 1993 and 1994, right? That was the case that initially launched Congress into toughening up the criminal copyright infringement rules. And in 1993 and 1994, almost none of the laws that I'm going to discuss right now were on the books. All of these laws have arisen since then. So what used to be a relatively unregulated environment now is subject to multiple regulations. And if the LaMacchia case were brought today and prosecutors didn't have criminal copyright infringement, he would still be in jail because of the new laws that have been put into place, I think. Let me give you some other examples of criminal laws that apply to wares trading. First of all, there's circumvention. Many of you have heard about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA. And the DMCA says it is illegal to circumvent a device that's used to protect a copyrighted work. It's also illegal to traffic in those circumvention devices, to distribute those devices, or to otherwise traffic in them. And almost every major wares group has to have a circumventer as part of the team, right? You can't really run your operations without one. And so that activity gives rise to liability on part of the entire group, even irrespective of the copyright infringement, based on the circumvention activity. To the extent that any of those groups distribute circumvention devices, then they're going to have a bonus basis on which to be prosecuted. But I think the circumventing, the actual breaking into or breaking or bypassing the copyright protection devices that software manufacturers put in their software, is going to be a basis on which someone could be prosecuted. Another basis that people can be prosecuted is what I'll call basically trespass of some sort or another, intruding into private spaces. I use the word hacking. That's a loaded word. I'm sorry if that offends you. I don't mean it to offend. Maybe it would be the word that you guys might use to describe it as cracking. But I'm talking about one of two things. When you intrude into private spaces, either to download software that you're going to convert into wares, or when you intrude into spaces and, quote, cause damage. So to the extent that WARES groups or WARES traders go into a private network to grab software, which can be done when one of the group members is an employee of that company and allows people to act, the rest of the group to access it, right? That would be the kind of thing that would be covered by this this particular provision. The other place that this will come up is where, quote, causes damage. And the example of this is where a WARES trading group or a WARES trader uses a private network in order to engage in his or her activities. And the use of the bandwidth and the security precautions that the company has to take to undo that usage constitutes the damage that gets legally recognized for this particular statute. Not every group engages in this, not every WARES trader engages in this, but I think many of them do. Certainly many WARES groups use university networks or corporation networks in order to run their business. And that's exactly the kind of thing that I think would be covered by this particular statute. Another statute that might apply is just your basic theft statute. So for example, it is not uncommon for WARES groups to set up a quid pro quo where a corporate employee gets access to the WARES database in exchange for getting the goods that that corporation makes. It might be computer servers. It might be types of physical objects. And basically, what the employee is doing in that situation is stealing corporate equipment to do a quid pro quo to get access to the database, and that's theft. Another criminal law that might apply is trade secret misappropriation. Usually the goal of WARES traders is to get their hands on software before it gets released. And those software versions that are pre-release could very well be protected as trade secrets. They have not been publicly disclosed. They derive value by the fact that they're not ready for prime time. And as a result, it's very possible that getting access to the pre-release versions would constitute trade secret misappropriation. And there are criminal protections against trade secret misappropriation, both state and federal. And the final criminal law that I want to talk about is also part of the DMCA. It doesn't get nearly as much attention as the circumvention or the anti-circumvention provisions, but it protects the integrity of what's called copyright management information. And what that means is that if a copyright owner slaps their name on a copyrighted work, or if they slap other types of identifying information on copyrighted work, and someone removes that information, they have violated the integrity of the copyright management information. Alternatively, if someone adds their own name as author, or if they add their own identifying information, that can also constitute a violation. And that can come up with situations like the .nfo file, right? Where someone says, I am the author of this crack of the WARES. And that's exactly the kind of thing that I think could very well be covered by this provision protecting copyright management information. Obviously, my point is not to go through all the nuances of these various laws. My point is to show that the regulatory field has tilted heavily since Lamakia. And as a result, it's likely that prosecutors will do this thing called charge stacking against future WARES traders, and it's going to be very hard for WARES traders to avoid the overall scope of these various laws, even if they can defeat the copyright infringement claim. Let me talk about some of the prosecutions that have been brought to date. And there have actually been, since 1997, in my accounting, only 9 different prosecutorial events. Now, there have been multiple defendants in some of those prosecutions, but there have been really only 9 prosecutorial events in the last 6 years. It has not been fairly common for prosecutions to be brought, but they are being brought, and they are being brought with some force. I would break down the class of defendants into 3 different buckets. There's the distribution groups. Remember, I talked about them in the beginning. Groups like Fastlane, Pirates with Attitude, Drink or Die, Rogue Warriors, all those groups have been heavily hit by prosecutions. It strikes me that if I were a prosecutor, that's likely where I would spend a bulk of my time. You get kind of better bang for the buck. You get a lot of defendants out of a single prosecution. But the prosecutors have also gone after these individual traders. I would put them in the bucket of what I would call these WARES collectors. These are people who seem to be just doing their own thing, not as part of any group, and yet prosecutors have still paid attention to them, which I find so interesting. Now, the first 3 prosecutions, Levy, Thornton and I don't want to butcher his name, but I think it's Baltutat, were brought at the very beginning of the prosecutions. And really, they were the Department of Justice's response to Congress's demand that, they get some action going. And I think these guys were kind of the initial proof that the Department of Justice was serious about criminal copyright infringement. But the Fitzgerald case just came out earlier this year, and this was a relatively small time. Does anyone know William Fitzgerald? Anyone know him? I think he was just a pretty small scale wares collector. And I've been trying to figure out why his number came up when so many other people's have not. And I can't really answer that question. There seems to be no obvious reason why he got picked. The third group of defendants are not wares traders in the classic sense, but they're close enough that they deserve to be up here. These are the movie traders. These are the people who get pre-release copies of movies and disseminate them to the internet. And as you can imagine, Congress really does not like that. That's exactly the kind of thing that gets them cranky. And so the Department of Justice does seem to be spending a little bit of time opportunistically to go after those people. Spadafore did a pre-release of one of the Star Wars movies. And Gonzalez just got prosecuted, or actually pled guilty in June for distributing a pre-release version of the Hulk movie. What I find so interesting about the prosecutions is that so far, everything I can tell is that the Department of Justice is batting 1,000. They have won every single prosecution that they've brought. Now, I cannot say that for certain. There may be prosecutions that never got reported that I haven't seen, but every one I've been able to find, they have won. And I've been trying to figure out, why are they so successful? Why have they been able to win every case? And one of the obvious reasons is that almost every defendant has pled guilty. Now, this is an interesting phenomenon. I've really been trying to figure out why most defendants plead guilty. And I've come up with a few different theories. Theory number one is that the sentencing guidelines give some leniency for admitting responsibility or taking responsibility. So the earlier someone takes responsibility, the more likely they're going to get that benefit under the leniency standard. So that might be theory number one. These guys know that they got busted, and they're just going to try and do the best they can to manage the resulting punishment. Another theory came from a former Department of Justice prosecutor, and I was asking about this, and he said, and please don't take offense at this, I'm just reporting what he said. He said, these guys behave the way that all other rich white males behave. And I didn't understand that statement. I asked him, I said, what do you mean by that? Is there something about rich white males being busted that has a common phenomenon? And he couldn't answer me about that. But he knew, based on his experience, that there was some commonality there. And I'm still trying to explore that. I'm not sure I buy that. I think there's something more going on. Here's my theory about why all the defendants plead guilty. And I don't mean any offense by this either. Please don't be mad at me if you don't agree. But my theory is that wares trading is a game. And everyone who participates knows that it's a game where the goal is to be the smartest. And I believe that many wares traders, when they get busted, feel like they lost and that someone outsmarted them. And they're willing to accept it on those terms. They're willing to say, okay, I played a game, someone beat me, I accept that I lost. That's just my theory, but I'm not sure about that. Maybe it's a combination of all three and other factors I haven't identified. But it is conspicuous. Almost every defendant pleads guilty. Only two of the defendants have ever taken their case all the way to a trial. Note, of course, both of them lost at the trial. Do you have a question on this point? So far, I have not seen the prosecutors really do any charge stacking, which I also find pretty interesting. I don't know why they aren't. It strikes me that is the inevitable consequence. But at the moment, none of these people, as I'm aware, have been prosecuted for anything but criminal copyright infringement as a standalone offense. I shouldn't say that. They sometimes will style it as a conspiracy theory or something like that. But the core lawsuit is based on criminal copyright infringement, not on the charge stacking. But I can't imagine why that's not coming. It seems to me that it's a natural thing. Just a couple other words about the prosecution. At least 19 defendants that I've been able to find have been sent to jail out of about 60 or so. The highest sentence is 46 months, or almost 4 years. That was John Sankus from Drink or Die. And the average, when someone gets jail time, the average is over 2 years. So people are going to jail for non-trivial periods of time when they get busted. Now, of course, not everyone is going to jail. Notice only 19 out of about 60 or so have gone. But when they end up in that bucket, I think the penalties have been reasonably severe. Let me offer up some policy concerns about wares trading. This first point should be obvious, that it is easy to overstate the degree to which wares traders actually cause copyright owners revenue loss. They definitely cause copyright owners teeth gnashing, right? But in terms of the actual amount of dollar value that copyright owners are losing because of wares trading, I think that that number is vastly overstated. Because I think that a lot of wares traders would never buy the copies. And those copies that are just downloaded from their activities, many of those are downloaded by other wares traders who are just going in a circle, right? So I think the amount of actual loss that the copyright owners are suffering is greatly overstated. The copyright owner lobbies do not go to Congress and say, we're only losing this amount. They go and say, we're losing every single time someone makes a copy. And they have convinced Congress of that, that is the case. So Congress is sold on the misbelief that every copy is a lost sale. And as a result, they treat it much more seriously than perhaps it ought to be. I also think that criminalizing wares trading may have counterproductive motivational effects. What I think part of what gets people excited about wares trading is the thrill of the illicit. It is the fact that you know you're doing something wrong and you're playing a game, and until you get caught, you beat the system. And the more rigorous and onerous the system is, the more that you win the game. I also think that it also has an ostracizing effect. To the extent that wares traders believe that they fit most closely with other wares traders as opposed to other social groups, I think ostracizing them by making their penalties more severe reinforces that the only friend I have in life is my other wares traders buddies. And it actually pushes them into the activity more than it pulls them out of it. But I think the biggest problem with the direction we're going is that in the process of trying to make sure that wares traders were subject to criminal copyright infringement, Congress criminalized almost all of us in this room, even if we've never engaged in wares trading. So for example, remember the definition of private financial gain is the receipt or expectation of receipt of anything of value. And I think that defines what people do when they engage in P2P file sharing, right? You trade, you download, and you give back. That's intrinsic in the software. And so I think a very strong argument can be made that Congress has already criminalized P2P file sharing based on the definition of private financial gain. As a result, many of us, if not all of us in this room, have committed criminal copyright infringement. But even if you don't come in under that prong, and you just look at that $1,000 of retail value, recognize that if you measure that over 180 days, that means you have to commit willfully infringing copies worth $5.56 a day of infringement to be considered a criminal infringer. And if you think about all the copies that you make in your life, you include the P2P file sharing, you include the copies of software that you make for your personal use, you include copies of things that you send to your friends. Those kinds of things, you add them all up, I imagine every single one of us in this room engages in $5.56 of infringement every day. And that makes all of us potentially at risk for prosecution. Let me give you some predictions. Congress is exasperated with people's unwillingness to listen to its laws. And the way I feel about it is that Congress, think about if you're a congressman or a congresswoman, you have been given this enormous power to change the world. And you use that power either by passing new laws or by holding hearings where you yell at people for not doing what you think they should be doing. And here we have a vast community of Americans who are not doing what Congress wants them to do. The copyright owners have convinced Congress that every single copy that's made is a lost sale. And Congress, internalizing that, says, I don't want my copyright owners, the engine of the American economy, to be losing money. I want them to be able to protect their interests. And yet nobody's listening to that, right? We do what we think is best, and we don't follow these laws that Congress has put on the books. So what does Congress do? Congress gets frustrated, says, I put a law in place, these people are not listening to me, I'm going to make them listen with the only way Congress knows how. Make the laws meaner, right? If you don't get a response from attack one, try it harder. So what Congress is doing is making meaner laws. Some of you may have seen the recent proposal by Conyers called ACCOPS, I can't remember what all that stands for, that has proposed that uploading a single file to the internet will be deemed to have engaged in a felony criminal copyright infringement. Has anyone in this room not committed that sin? Right? What's the point? Congress already has on the books a pretty draconian law. Why does it need more? Because Congress is frustrated that you aren't listening to it. It has a vision for the world that none of us subscribe to. And why not? And I put up the example that we do not respect unjust laws. Part of our decision about what laws to comply with and what laws we don't care about depends on our own internal morals and notions of justice. And when Congress makes laws that are just so completely asinine in our reality, we cannot respect them. And laws that we cannot respect cannot be followed. Having said that, Congress is not going to give up. Congress is like a pit bull that has sunk its teeth into this problem and is not letting go. And so the next devolution is for Congress to get what it wants by busting P2P file shares. And Congress has demanded that the Department of Justice prosecute P2P file shares. And they've also put in place this proposal that is squarely designed to cover P2P file sharing. But you can imagine that the Department of Justice does not want to do that, right? If you're a prosecutor, you don't want to prosecute your grandma, right? You don't want to prosecute your teenage niece, right? You want to go after the bad guys, the people that we all would agree are bad guys. And P2P file shares are all of us in this room. And I'd like to think not all of us in this room are bad guys. So there's an inherent tension in the Department of Justice. Congress has said, we expect you to go get these P2P file shares, and the Department of Justice doesn't want to go there. So what are they going to do? What they can do is look for sacrificial lambs. They can say, Congress, you want people busted under your laws? I'm going to go find people who are not the average American. I'm going to find people that the average American can distinguish their conduct from their own. And I believe, and this may be a little heretical in this room, but I believe that most Americans distinguish wares trading from P2P file sharing. I don't, from a legal standpoint, have any basis to do so. But I think the average American says, oh, there's those wares traders out there. Those guys aren't the people I support. P2P file sharing? Yeah, we all do that. And so P2P file sharing, so wares trading offers up a way for the Department of Justice to satisfy the Congress's bloodlust without actually putting all of the American public in a panic. And as a result, it is my prediction that that will mean more wares traders are going to go to jail. I have said a lot. I know a lot of you have questions. Let's get into it. Questions? Yeah. Mm-hmm. It would be valued to the defendant. I think, although you could argue that the other way. Your question's a fair one. Yeah, I think it's a more tangible belief, but I don't. There's not been any case law interpreting that particular question, so I can only tell you my guess. Okay, questions? Yes. Uh huh. So the point is that abandonware traders and people who trade, for example, concert bootleggers or concert bootlegs do not commit financial gain because these things were never for sale. I'm sorry, they're not a gain because they were never for sale. I think that would be relevant under the definition of fair use. Remember, the last factor is the effect on the market. And so something that's not available for sale, by definition, cannot have a negative effect on the market. Now, courts have manipulated that factor, as with all those fair use factors, to say copyright owners have the right to choose not to allow a market to exist. And so you detrimentally affect their choice not to create a market. So on that basis, you can still twist the words around to find that there's a detrimental effect on a market that does not exist. Now, with respect to something like concert bootlegs, sometimes those, in fact, do have market value. In fact, sometimes the recording artists will go back and mine their concerts to look for old versions to put out a live album. And so I'm not sure I would agree with you that those are in the same bucket as something that never has any future value. But the classic abandonware, which someone has said, I'm never going to re-commercialize this, should be something that has no detrimental effect on the market, yet you can still manipulate that test to come out otherwise. Questions? Yeah, in the back. Is there a legal definition of circumvention device? You know, I have to look at the statute again. I don't think that the words are a whole lot more precise than what I just said. They say it's, I think, actually a technological device to control access to a copyrighted work. I don't know if that's more precise for you or not, but I think that's the definition, something with a few more extra words. Go ahead. Yes. Well, and that's a great question. So, for example, you may be familiar with the Lexmark case, which involves the authentication between a printer cartridge and the printer, and so people the printer manufacturers have said, I'm going to put a special device into my printer cartridges, and that will prevent anyone from making compatible devices to it. And that is now under litigation to suggest whether or not that is an anti-circumvention device. There's also a case involving garage door openers, the same exact type of theory, whether or not your receiver can work with a garage door opener. So I think we're at the cusp of defining that better. The definition could be as broad as you think it is. It could be anything that controls access to a copyrighted work, even if it's the most ridiculous and childlike approach. If it's something, that could be considered an anti-circumvention device. And we're waiting for that to see if that's the case. Yeah, go ahead. Of course, when these people are settling, they're still, or you know, when they're pleading guilty, they're still going to jail in many cases. So all that does is maybe get them out faster. But they're not going to trial. They might win. There might be a slim chance of avoiding that jail time, and yet they're not taking that risk. But that's right. You got to spend a lot of money. That's right. And so, I'm sorry, the point was about DirecTV and devices to scramble DirecTV and the protections against those. And I think if I were still in private practice and I had clients who had copyrighted works, I would tell them to build in anti-circumvention devices, even if they were trivial, because that creates a new benefit, a new way of protecting that copyrighted work, even if all the other ways in which that work was supposed to be protected would fail. Okay. I see. Okay. Yeah, question. You tell me when I need to get off stage, and I will. Okay, we're going to go off stage. Okay, so we're going to move outside. One last point. As I said, I have an article that gives you a lot more detail on everything that we discussed. It should be on the CD-ROM. If you want me to email you a copy, just give me a card or your email address, and I'll send it to you when I get back into the office. Thanks very much.